Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. The new farm bill passed the House Agriculture Committee on Thursday. And you're wondering, well, what do we care in New York City and vicinity about a farm bill? Well, this, with Speaker Pelosi's support, is expected to come before the full House this week. And once every 5 years, this massive document known as the Farm Bill comes up for reauthorization. So before you say to yourself, wait a minute, isn't this bill the province of the heartland and that ain't me? My next guest wants to ask you some questions. Why does a 2-liter bottle of soda cost less than fresh squeezed orange juice? Why is it that so many overweight people are precisely those with the least amount of money to spend on food? Michael Pollan lays the blame for at least some of this at the feet of the Farm Bill. He's watched the Farm Bill closely this year and has taken a leading role in trying to draw more attention to the links between food, the environment, and U.S. agriculture policy. You know Michael Pollan from his past writing. Perhaps he writes for the New York Times Magazine, teaches journalism at UC Berkeley, and is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of 4 Meals. And we have linked to his article, You Are What You Grow, on our webpage. Michael Pollan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
So even you admit that the Farm Bill is a resolutely unglamorous and head-hurtingly complicated piece of legislation, your words. Why should we care?
Because basically it's true, and I don't recommend anyone try to read it. But it really is the rules of the food system that we all eat by. And it is the reason, it is the answer to your question, why that soda is cheaper than that orange juice or that milk, and why the cheapest calories in the supermarket are the least healthy ones. Because it basically decides what kinds of calories the government will support the growing of. And by and large, the government supports the growing of corn, soybeans, and wheat, as well as some rice and cotton, and does next to nothing for fresh produce, next to nothing for local agriculture, next to nothing for organic agriculture. So basically, although the bill has always been treated as, you know, the private preserve of the farm states and their legislators, it's affecting all of us. And this year, for the first time, ordinary eaters seem to be paying attention and giving conniptions to the people in the House who'd like to pass a bill that's very much business as usual.
You've written that the phrase farm bill itself is a misnomer. Why?
Because it's really a food bill. Farm bill is one of the many, many ways that, using that term, one of the many, many ways that these farm state legislatures are trying to keep us, people who live on the coast, people who live in the cities, from paying attention to what they're doing. They want to treat it as a special interest piece of legislation that gives, you know, huge amounts of subsidies, about $20 billion a year, to a very small handful of farmers, and through them to a very small handful of corporations, because the real beneficiary of this isn't really pitting the small upstate New York organic farmer against the big cotton farmer or soy farmer in Iowa. It's really pitting that small farmer against ADM and Cargill and Coca-Cola, because the real beneficiary of farm subsidies are the buyers of those cheap raw materials for junk food. The farmers actually, year after year, get screwed by this bill. Prices, because the more they subsidize farmers, the lower prices go, and you know, the struggle goes on for the farmers. But what you have, fairly reliably, at least until the ethanol boom this year, is very cheap commodities as a result of the farm bill. And that is a boon if you're feeding livestock on a feedlot, if you're making soda, if you're making Twinkies, it's a great thing. So those are the real beneficiaries, and so far at least, their sway over this process has not been shaken.
We can take some phone calls. Anybody who used to live in any farm belt area and want to call in on how the farm belt the farm bill affected you or your family or large business. We don't want to get the small family farmer confused with the agribusiness corporations. That's exactly the distinction that Michael Pollan is trying to make. But you can call in, or any of you who've never come any closer to a farm than the Green Market at Union Square. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Because, Michael, when we hear the term farm bill, we often think subsidies, especially in New York. We think, oh, gosh, we have all these needs, and, you know, and they're throwing money at farmers not to grow crops. But but really, what started during the Great Depression to support small farmers has become something entirely other.
Well, that's right, Brian. I mean, we've been supporting farmers in one way or another since the Depression. And the reason we started doing that is that the free market in agriculture doesn't work very well. Farming is prone to these crises of overproduction where, you know, you've got millions of farmers and very few buyers, and the farmers end up just producing more and more every year, especially as technology gets better, and so prices collapse. And there was a time in the beginning of the Depression where the price of corn essentially fell to zero, and we realized, well, we needed corn to be produced in this country, and we needed farmers to survive. So what we did for a long time is we set kind of the equivalent of a minimum wage for crop prices, so that if the price of corn got below what it cost to produce it, the government would lend you money, so you didn't have to sell your crop at less than it cost you to produce it. And this kind of floor is basically how it worked all the way up until the 1970s. The floor did not suit the big agribusiness companies because it kept prices a little bit higher. So they pushed the government under President Nixon to change the system. And instead of lending farmers money for the difference between the market price and what it cost them to produce the corn, basically just cut them a check for the difference and allowed them, that became a subsidy, and that allowed them to dump that corn on the market at whatever the price was, which of course drove the price down further. So this was an enormous boon to the buyers of these cheap subsidies, and indeed, you know, you could argue to certain consumers, because it gave us much cheaper food.
Right.
I mean, if you go back to the 70s, the price of junk food has gone down by somewhere between 10% and 13%.
Junk food.
Now, talking about soda and chips and things like that.
And you can buy a liter of soda, also known as liquid corn, according to you, for all the corn syrup in the non-diet versions, far more cheaply than you can buy organic fruits or vegetables or, let's say, orange juice. So how is it, in your words, that the nation's agricultural policies operate at cross purposes with its public health objectives? Is this on purpose?
Well, since this period I'm describing in the 70s, as the price of junk food has gone down and the price of whole foods, fruits and vegetables, has gone up, we've also had an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. So at the same time you have the Surgeon General decrying this public health crisis, as they've called it in Washington, you have the Congress passing bills that, in effect, are subsidizing the price of high fructose corn syrup. And if our public health goal is to get a handle on diabetes and obesity, we should not be making high fructose corn syrup cheap. And that's exactly what we're doing. And that's why those of us who care about public health are taking an interest in this bill, much to the resentment, by the way, of the usual characters in Washington.
Huh.
Colin Peterson, the head of the House Ag Committee, gave a quote in the newspaper on Friday after he passed his bill saying, "These people in the cities complaining about the farm bill do not know what they're talking about." In other words, bug out. This is our legislation. And I think that's really the key, is it's not their legislation because it's our food supply.
Michael Pollan, my guest on WNYC, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Foreign Meals. Maybe you saw his April New York Times Magazine article, "You Are What You Grow." And he's kind of blowing the whistle on what the farm bill really is and really does, especially with respect to our health. Jan in a plain field. Oh, no, it's Jan in Plainfield, New Jersey. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
You're not in a plain field.
No, it's a very beautiful field. But it's not a farm.
It's a suburb.
Thanks
yes.
for taking my call.
What's your question, real quick?
I'm glad that you're talking about this. I have a couple of comments to add. One thing is that animal welfare activists have been fighting for years to outlaw farmers putting diseased animals who may have things like mad cow into food supply, and the farm lobby, so to speak, has been fighting furiously. And if you're concerned about human health beyond obesity, there's that factor.
Let me ask Michael Pollan if you think that is a real fear, or is she just being alarmist?
No, I think there is a fear. I think downer cattle should be kept out of the food supply. And, you know, a lot of these issues regulating animal agriculture are enshrined in the Farm Bill as well, and we need to pay attention to those as well. It's not just, as you pointed out, about subsidies. There's a whole lot. It's a very complicated piece of legislation. Food stamps are here, too, in the Farm Bill. Aspects of the school lunch program. Country of origin labeling, whether when you go to the store you will be told whether the meat you're buying came from Australia or the United States. All these things are part of the food bill. How easy it is for small farmers to have access to slaughter facilities.
Mm-hmm.
How many USDA inspectors will there be for meat? How will that inspection be performed? It's all there, and the battle is really between, you know, consumers looking for a healthy and wholesome food supply and large producers who really want a free hand to, you know, do it the way they want with government help.
Here is George in Manhattan, who says he has run farms in Arkansas and Texas. Hey,
yes,
George.
Good morning, Brian. The joke was always I was a Manhattan farmer.
Mm-hmm.
You and Eddie Albert.
Yeah, I guess so. We had both a little bit of cotton, soya beans, which did not get subsidized, and rice, which was heavily subsidized. And what effectively happened was that as part of this allocation program, the farm bureaus in each of the counties that we operated in, the farmers themselves essentially ran it. And the Department of Agriculture would say, how much had you grown on a given date in a certain year? And that became the basis upon which they did the allocation for rice. And you kept that allocation forever, effectively. It went along with the land, so you had to actually own the land or control the land. But where you actually planted it or whether you even planted it didn't really matter.
So was it corrupt?
Oh, no, no, no. It's the way the system was set up. It's not. Everything was out in the open. There's nothing corrupt about it. In effect, you were receiving monies not to grow rice, for example. Therefore, the yields would go up for others. That was the essence of it. And it's been done with many of the other top grains as well.
So the profits would go up for others.
And then the farmer would still have a level that he could do. Also, I used to have tenant farmers, and these poor fellows, I didn't own the land. I operated it for somebody. But these farmers would, they would have loved to have had the land and had the rice allocation, and they could probably more efficiently have grown it had they been able to take the allocations and put them concentrated on, let's say, 2,000 acres someplace.
Interesting. Michael Pollan, anything on that?
Yeah, there are now farmers who are already dead still receiving their subsidy checks from the government. I mean, there's a lot of abuse of the system, too. But, yeah, the basic idea often did provide for people to get paid not to grow food. And I'm not sure on its face that that's always a bad idea. Shrinking the supply of a crop like corn or soybeans is not necessarily a bad idea, although there are better ways to do it. And Tom Harkin in the Senate, the head of the Senate Agriculture Committee, has some very interesting proposals, something called the Conservation Security Program, where you don't, instead of paying the farmer by the bushel for what he can grow, you pay them to be stewards of the land and to put more of the land in grass or to, you know, keep wetlands out of production and actually pay them to be environmental stewards. And it's a way to put some money in the farmer's pocket without encouraging him to overproduce.
Michael,
which is
really
where the problem comes in.
We have 1 minute left. Just give me the quick politics of this. Did this actually pass the House? I understand that at least it passed the Agriculture Committee. Nancy Pelosi supports it, but the president is unhappy.
Yeah, well, the president, it's a funny situation. The president is looking for more reform than Nancy Pelosi. He's asking for a $250,000 cap on subsidies. Pelosi has accepted a $1 million cap, which with lots of loopholes. Pelosi has gotten behind a bill that is not reformed by any stretch of the imagination. However, there are a lot of people in the House, including her delegation in California, that are very upset about this and want to see a debate over some genuine reform. And we may get this week. If you're interested in the issue, Nancy Pelosi is the person who needs to hear from you because she has really, you know, betrayed her commitment to children, to a sustainable agriculture, and to a healthier food system. She has political reasons for doing it. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of freshmen on the Ag Committee who she's trying to help out.
Actual pork for actual pork farmers and all of that. Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma and the article in the New York Times, You Are What You Grow, in April, which we have linked to on our homepage at WNYC.org. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.